Next month, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's 10-part, 18-hour documentary, The Vietnam War, will once again bring one of modern history's ugliest wars into our living rooms, leading us 42 years after the fall of Saigon to reevaluate a war that many argue shattered America's innocence because it divided families, generations, and our nation as a whole. One of the seminal books from that time, Philip Caputo's A Rumor of War, provided the first and perhaps most personal look into those tragic events. It's just been reissued in a 40th anniversary edition with a new foreword by Kevin Powers, and I'm very pleased it has brought Philip Caputo back to our show. Welcome back.
Well, it's great to be here again.
What has it been like for you to revisit A Rumor of War and to find yourself discussing once again those Vietnam experiences?
Rather strange. When I wrote the book way back in the early 70s and published it in the late 70s, I didn't really expect it to do very much, and I certainly didn't expect that it would still be around 40 years from now, from then. And it amazes me that this that conflict and that whole event, which I would just say the 60s, still resonates today.
In fact, a couple of months ago, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick had an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which they discussed the fact that in the over four decades since the end of the Vietnam War, we haven't been able to put it completely behind us and work toward the wounds that were inflicted on the nation. Do you agree with them?
Oh, very much. I would say that I agree with them to the second power, because it's been my personal view, and I think I could support it, that a lot of the divisions and fractures that we see in our society today started back then. I've compared it in my own mind, in some things I've written, to the sort of crack that you get in a windshield, and then if you don't tend to it, it tends to craze the entire windshield, and you can't really quite trace where the original break was.
Now, why that war? We were involved in a number of other very divisive wars, the Civil War, the Mexican War, Spanish-American War, World War I had a major impact on the history of America. What makes the Vietnam War different?
Well, it was similar to a lot of other conflicts, obviously. War is war. But I think that probably what made two of the things that made the difference were is that, first of all, it was fought by a largely drafted army, a conscript army. So you were asking these citizen soldiers to fight in this politically and morally dubious conflict, that literally to risk and in some cases give their lives.
It wasn't seen as a good war in the way World War I and World War II.
Oh, no. I think almost from the beginning, certainly from 1967 on, it lost any illusion that this was a good war. And then the other factor was that our political and military leaders lied to the American public about it consistently and flagrantly throughout the entire 10 years that we fought in that war.
And the American public got changed views over time. I've spoken to a number of journalists who went there. And they went, they said, with a belief in the war, and they had patriotic fervor, but very quickly became disillusioned and started sending back different kinds of reports after just a few months.
Yeah, David Halberstam was one of those journalists, and
Marlene Sanders was another one.
There were any number of them. That was paralleled, by the way, too, to a lot of us who fought in the war, is you heard surprisingly dissident, if you want to call it that, comments from the fighting men that were in the war fairly early, 1966 certainly, and 1967, but even by 66, I remember non-commissioned officers and enlisted men in the battalion I was with expressing some very grave doubts about why we were there.
Why do you think there's renewed interest in the war now, in the Vietnam War now? Although I suspect we're going to start talking about the Korean War in the next few months, which another ambiguous war that we got involved with.
Right. That was somewhat ambiguous. It wasn't as ambiguous as Vietnam. It certainly didn't last as long. And the other thing was that I think you have to see that the Vietnam War was the central event of a revolutionary era in American society. I mean, you can't separate the war from the civil rights movement, from the feminist movement, even from the environmental movement. And our society and our culture changed drastically between 1963 and 1975, and that's why there is this fascination with the war, if I can use the word fascination.
Many people at the time thought that America was going to move far to the left as a result of the war. That didn't happen.
No, it did not. And as a matter of fact, I tend to think that a lot of the philosophies and outlooks of the left at the time, what was then called the new left, now would be the old left, have been adopted by the so-called modern alt-right, the alternate right. As a matter of fact, you know, America became, in a lot of ways, more conservative, both economically as well as in other aspects.
During the heat of the Afghan war and the war in Iraq, there was a lot of talk about how we hadn't learned the lessons of Vietnam. Have we learned any lessons from the Vietnam War that we've been able to apply since?
You know, Leonard, my favorite, I've been asked that probably
yeah, but you started
27,000 times.
As I began asking that question, yeah. The smile came on pretty early.
Well, my favorite quote was from John Kenneth Galbraith, who said that the lesson of Vietnam is that we should never, ever again get involved in a war in Vietnam. That's kind of how I feel. I don't think there's much that you can apply to, even though there are similarities to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Were you involved in making the documentary, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick?
I appear in it as one of the people interviewed, yes, but I was not involved in actually making it, no.
When we speak about Vietnam, it's often suggested that it was a time of a loss of innocence. Do you think that that's true? And was that true more of Vietnam than other wars?
Probably. There is another comment I can't remember. I can't attribute this one, but I heard that America loses its innocence every 10 years and then manages to recapture it. Probably, I would say that we did, and it was an innocence that I think grew out of the aftermath of World War II. Certainly, when you look back and you read some of Mark Twain's comments about the Spanish-American War and the Philippine insurrection that followed it, very, very vituperative and fiery comments that he had on there that didn't suggest to me that America was all that innocent even back then.
But I guess because we thought World War II was a good war, we fought the good fight and won, although we seem to be fighting that war again philosophically just this weekend, perhaps we really felt that we had become the major power in the world as a result of World War II.
So that
innocence would have come along with that. We were the good guys. We did the Marshall Plan. We helped Europe recover. We helped Japan recover.
Well, we did do all those things. I mean, I really think that the way America fought World War II and the way we rebuilt Japan and Europe, or I should say helped rebuild it, reflected the very best that's in us.
In the case of Vietnam, do you think another reason for that, perhaps that loss of innocence, was that Watergate followed right after the end of the war?
Well,
Because Watergate is coming up again as a topic of discussion.
I think in the sense that it was the awareness that the government had been duplicitous toward the American public for a decade, and it was as though Watergate was the logical outcome and the culmination of that kind of mendacity.
Given what happened over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, how do you see the divisions in our country today versus the political, cultural, and generational divisions that split the country during the time of Vietnam?
Well, I personally think they're worse. Even though there was more violence during the 60s than there is now, these divisions now are very worrisome. When I saw what happened there in Virginia, I had this very, very uncomfortable feeling that I was seeing the possible beginnings of some second American Civil War. I mean, these white supremacists showed up with helmets and shields and, I mean, ready to do battle. And they don't show any signs of going away or retreating back to the margins from which they came. If anything, they're at the gates of the mainstream.
I think perhaps the thing that shocked people the most was seeing the swastikas. The Confederate flags we've kind of become immune to. Even KKK is part of the lingering culture, although I think most people saw it as almost dead. But then when you see these people who have quotations from Hitler on their T-shirts and are carrying flags with swastikas, you wonder, where have they been?
Well,
been there?
Oh, yeah, yes.
And
yes,
were they there during the Vietnam War?
I don't know if they were there during the Vietnam War, but they were definitely there in the aftermath of the war in the 80s. I had done a novel that was published back in the early 90s, and I had done quite a bit of research into these white supremacist groups, and they were definitely there then, but they were...
I thought they were all in Idaho.
No. This was in California, and they were quite marginalized then, and they're not now. But I have to say that seeing a crowd of these young guys with their in the Nazi stiff arm salute gave me a physical chill.
My guest is Philip Caputo, whose Rumor of War has just been reissued with a new foreword by Kevin Powers, the 40th anniversary edition from Picador. We'll continue our conversation after this. So we are back with Philip Caputo. A new edition, a 40th anniversary edition, has just been of his classic book, Rumor of War, has been issued by Picador. And let's talk a bit about the war. How early in the progress of the war did officials in the U.S. government begin to feel that it might be unwinnable?
Well, from what I've read, they thought it was unwinnable before they even got into it.
We kind of slid into it accidentally. But the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
It wasn't accidental. I mean, if you read, I think it was Michael Beschloss did an entire book on the Johnson tapes. They were tape recordings of Johnson's phone conversations from the Oval Office and in the Oval Office with various senators and cabinet officials. And I can't quote exactly what he said, but he said, in effect, that he didn't want to really get in there. He didn't want to get involved in the war because he couldn't see how we could win it. And nevertheless, even McNamara, by the way, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, was extremely skeptical about our ability to win it. But because of the Cold War pressures and the pressures that were arising from the Republicans or from the more conservative wing of the foreign policy establishment, they were terrified that they and the Democrats would be branded as appeasers of communism, and consequently they would lose out on their ability to advance their domestic agenda.
And now we're hearing similar kinds of arguments with a different party in power. The you know, you got to talk tough. Or the peace.
Well, there. I mean, there's a difference between talking tough and this kind of bombast. I mean, Trump sounds like he's Kim's twin, verbally. I mean,
but we were talking about bombing Hanoi, and there were
many. Curtis LeMay, the head of the Strategic Air Command, talked about bombing them back into the Stone Age and so forth. They nobody that I knew of was publicly speaking about using nukes.
You mentioned that the government lied for a long time about the difficulties we were facing in Vietnam. Why did they lie? I mean, in the end, they must have realized it was going to come back to haunt them.
No, Leonard, no. I mean, politicians never learn that lesson. You can see what happens in their personal lives. You know, they get involved in some sex or economic scandal, thinking they're going to get away with it, even though the proof is right in front of them that you never get away with it. And I think it was the same thing with that war, that if they just kept saying that the enemy's strength wasn't as great as it was, or that we're actually winning because we killed more of them than they killed of us, or whatever other strategy they might employ, they kind of thought that they would keep the support of the American people that way, and they did for quite a long time.
Where were you ideologically when the war began?
Well, when the war began, I was just like those correspondents you spoke of earlier. I was very patriotic, kind of eager to duplicate the feats of my uncles and other relatives in World War II.
They had served in the military, other members of your family?
Yes, they did.
And you were ROTC in the early 60s.
Right. It wasn't called. I was in the Marine Corps, and we didn't call it ROTC. We had another acronym for it, but nevertheless, it was the same thing.
Was that just because that was the thing to do at college?
No, not necessarily. It was a thing to do in the sense that because the draft was faced by every able-bodied male, you knew that you would have to, as we used the phrase back then, fulfill your military obligation. So I was told by my uncles, all of whom were enlisted men in World War II, they said, if you're going to go in, go as an officer. It's better, you know, than being a
So you were second enlisted lieutenant?
Yes.
The equivalent.
Yeah.
How old were you when you arrived in Vietnam in March 1965?
22.
And as you said, at that time you were gung-ho. How did the American military, the people you met when you got there, what were they telling you about what you were facing?
Oh, well, there weren't very many American military there then. I was, in fact, with the 1st Brigade of American combat troops that were committed to the war. The Americans that were in the war then were mostly advisors, both Australians and Americans. And they tried to sober us up, so to speak. They kind of thought we were so gung-ho that we actually thought, some of us anyway, that our mere presence there would terrify the Viet Cong into surrendering.
At one point,
that's how stupid we were.
Well, we didn't understand guerrilla warfare.
No, we didn't. And that was, by the way, though, it was, President Kennedy was a big proponent of counterinsurgency warfare with his Green Beret advisors and so forth. And that part of the romance, if I can use that word, for the war in those days was that you would be fighting in this conflict that was championed by the Prince of Camelot.
And a number of Kennedy administration people who've been guests on this show have talked about whether Kennedy would have taken us into the war or not, and it was pretty much an even split.
Yeah, I rather think that he would have, yes.
At one point in the book, you write, anyone who fought in Vietnam, if he's honest about himself, will have to admit he enjoyed the compelling attractiveness of combat. After all these years, can you still conjure up those feelings?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't want to do it again, but I can conjure them up in the sense of being able to remember that strange excitement of battle. And by the way, that goes back all the way to Homer. Mm-hmm. I recently reread in a translation of the Iliad. And Homer speaks over and over again, sometimes in the same line, of the absolute horrors of combat, and then he uses the phrase, the joy of battle.
Well, I guess they didn't use the word adrenaline
no,
rush.
No.
But many journalists have talked about covering wars, partly because they just get addicted to that adrenaline rush.
Yeah, you do. I was a war correspondent after I was out of the Marine Corps and covered maybe 5 or 6 conflicts, and sometimes just because they were on my beat, so to speak. But also, I have to admit that I wanted to recreate that adrenal rush.
But you also were involved in what we would call the horrors of war. As a young officer, you were charged with ordering the murder of 2 Vietnamese civilians. When you wrote the book, what were your feelings then? Well, what were your feelings at the time when you wrote the book and now in retrospect?
Well, one of the things that the main theme of A Rumor of War is the journey that I made psychologically from the false light of youthful illusions down into the darkness of my own soul, and then a rising into, I think, the truer light of self-knowledge. Now, I know that sounds awfully abstract, but...
But you suggested a lot of people went through that, a similar kind of transformation.
Oh, I think almost everybody that was there then. I mean, I know that when I was undergoing that investigation, that any number of Marines, officers, as well as enlisted, just said that what's happening to you has happened to all of us. So when I was writing the book, anyway, I said, I have got to confront this demon, this devil that I know is within me, and write about it as honestly as I can, and as well as I can. And I still look back on that feeling that I did do that as far as the writing of it goes. But I must say that incident, although we thought that these 2 Vietnamese, what turned out to be Vietnamese civilians, we had every bit of evidence that we could gather at that time that they were Viet Cong. They weren't.
But why would you just take them as prisoners?
Well, why wouldn't we take them as prisoners? One of the things was that we were told by the commandant of the Marine Corps at that time that our job was to, quote-unquote, kill VC. That's all you're supposed to do, kill the Viet Cong. And we used to get rewarded for body counts, both by unit and individual, you know. But in fact, my orders had been to capture these guys if possible. And I said, but if they give you the slightest bit of trouble, I said, kill them. And when I look back on that, even to this day, is that I sometimes feel like I'm looking back at an alter ego of some kind, some double goer that nevertheless was me.
In the book, you describe soldiers being pushed to the limits of their physical capabilities and the combat conditions they experienced, which resulted in murderous rages followed by guilt and remorse and then a sense of degradation.
That's pretty powerful.
Is that why we see PTSD?
Sure you do. Combat is a brutalizing experience. Nobody can go through it without being brutalized. Now, if you know, the angels are with you, you will come out of that brutalization, in fact, a better human being than you were before. But I want to add that nevertheless, that it's very difficult for me to express just how degrading and brutalizing it is. And by the way, you know, it's one of the reasons I'll have to admit that I've opposed consistently allowing women in the military to go into combat roles.
You just want to spare them.
Yeah, I have three granddaughters. The thought that any of them would experience what I did then, and by the way, my experiences were fairly mild compared to later on in the war.
So, but it's better, it's okay for men to go through those things?
No, it's not okay. But since war seems to be inevitable, war seems to be part of the human condition, then I would say that we ought to limit it as much as we can.
A listener, Larry from Nyack, called in. He wants to know what effect the Vietnam War has had on the drug problems that the U.S. has experienced since.
I don't think it the war itself has. I think the atmosphere of the 60s is more responsible for the drug use that we now see.
But there was a lot of drug abuse in the U.S. military.
There was, but you know what? It was exaggerated. There were, yes, guys smoked dope, guys found heroin and all that, but they were mostly in the rear areas. It was the atmosphere of throwing off old ways of doing things, old moral strictures that resulted in, I think, the tolerance of drug use.
In the last 15 seconds that we have here, do you think that the conversation would be very different if we hadn't left the way that we did, if we actually had perhaps won the war?
It may have been. Certainly, I would. Maybe the conversation would be. Certainly, I think the book I wrote wouldn't have been any different.
Philip Caputo's book, A Rumor of War, has just been reissued with a new foreword by Kevin Powers, a 40th anniversary edition by Picador, and it has been my great pleasure to have him as a guest on our show again. Thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks, Leonard, for having me on the show.